Meanwhile, the government has implemented measures to encourage the development of agriculture. One trend this sector is witnessing is the application of smart technologies for the cultivation and harvest of various products. There has also been a boom in developing greenhouses and green practices to preserve natural resources. The word plastic was initially used to describe pliable and easily shaped objects. However, it only recently became a name for a category of materials called polymers. Such materials are abundant in nature. Take cellulose, for example. It's the material that makes up the cell walls of plants. However, synthetic polymers are a more recent invention of the last 150 years. These come from the plentiful carbon atoms found in fossil fuels. Since then, they have become an integral part of the industry, technology, and even various sciences. We will explore Iran's plastic and polymer productions. We will also check out some of its downstream markets and their contributions to the national economy. These days, we use more plastic than ever before. It's terrible. So where does this material come from? And what goes into making this stuff? Let's find out. Our quest for answers led us to a company specializing in making various polymer products. Parsa Polymer Sharif was established some 20 years ago and is a knowledge-based company that was born in the research department of the University of Sharif. As a leading advanced polymer compound manufacturer, it makes various products essential to everyday living. It produces compounds based on commodity thermoplastic resins like PP, PE, and the famous PET, or PET. It also engineers resins like PVC, and so much more. This knowledge-based company is a major supplier of raw materials to many industries. Some include original equipment manufacturers in the automotive market and PVC pipe producers in the construction industry. Over the years, this company has helped Iran save millions on products that would otherwise be imported. This firm has three main functions: research and development, innovation center, and production. It also has a brand new line for researching and producing biodegradable polymers for the packaging industry. Most of the raw materials needed for production are domestically purchased. When this stuff enters the company, it is first tested and graded based on its quality. Then, according to its intended use, the raw material is formulated and sent to machines for production.
Machines used in the polymer industry utilizes some of the most advanced machinery for production. The extruder is one of the most commonly used machines. They play a central role in plastic production. Extruder lines are the largest converters of plastics worldwide. Some of these machines can be domestically manufactured while others are still imported.
Its products are all tested in its well-equipped research and development lab. The various granules and resin compounds undergo over a dozen tests while being analyzed for quality here. Also, new product formulas are created in this highly technical research and development department. Through these facilities, the company is expanding its product portfolio. Products made here are produced along the lines of exports. So, national and international quality standards are implemented during the production processes. This means the quality of products found here doesn't just match international standards, they go beyond the quality of competing foreign brands in the international arena. The headquarters of this company is located in Sharif University Advanced Technologies Incubator. Owing to this, it has strong relations and collaborations with the scientific community. It has also been awarded for its contributions to the scientific and industrial sectors over the past years. This knowledge-based company also exports its products. The company has a unique future vision strongly intertwined with sustainable business development. This is partly due to its forward thinking and social and environmental responsibility outlook.
Now, polymers are the primary materials that build many other products. Plastic items have different polymer formulations depending on their application. The majority of polymers made in Iran are domestically consumed. Some of its biggest customers are in the construction sector. Also, plastic is extensively used in the medical industry and transportation.
Almost everything around us is either made of plastic or has some plastic component. Moreover, plastic has played a central role in the development of the medical industry over the past 60 years. These materials are used to create hemodialysis machines, disposable needles, IV drips, and testing equipment vital to modern medicine. Plastics have also had a considerable impact on developing high-quality prosthetics. The National Medical Device Directorate estimates that Iran's share in the global medical device market will reach well over $7 billion in the next 3 years. PVC materials are also largely used in Iran's construction industry. For example, Iran's Doors and Windows Manufacturers Association estimates the domestic demand for PVC doors and windows is around 35,000 tons annually. This is partly due to the current residential construction boom in the country. The home appliance industry is also another mammoth customer of the polymer industry. Based on figures from the Ministry of Industry, Mining and Trade, Iran has doubled its production in this sector over the last 3 years. In 2021, around 15 million home appliance units were produced, with exports soaring to roughly $140 million. So, polymer production is key in expanding many manufacturing industries, which have raked in large amounts of foreign revenue for the country.
Well, I believe it is that time of the show where I should take a little break and pass the action over to my good friend and colleague out there on the field. Take it away.
Despite all the advancements in technology and the problems it has solved, food security is one it hasn't. In fact, it is becoming more and more of an issue beyond the countries that have always been grappling with it. One solution is to, well, end inflation and the global economic crisis, but that's hardly a solution. There's no end in sight with that. But another way is to use technology to make things more efficient. We wouldn't be needing more land because we're not getting it thanks to desertification of more and more land. We also wouldn't be needing more water because we're also not getting it, also thanks to desertification. We would actually need less of both if only we could manage our resources better.
Iran has some potential for farming and agriculture, and that's a massive understatement if you've ever heard one. But we could definitely do with some improvements, some innovations in the field, especially with irrigation, because, well, we've been experiencing some drought and some water shortages a little bit more than what climate change would warrant. And that's why we're here to check out a smart greenhouse that believes has the answer, the shakeup that the industry needs to be a lot more efficient, especially with water, plus some extra goodies. So stay tuned to this episode of The Bazaar to check out what they've been able to come up with.
About that efficiency, greenhouses can help provide that by creating a controlled environment that, while it could be much smaller than a field, it can yield higher quality produce and more produce per acre. Greenhouses can protect the crops and vegetables from extreme weather conditions, pests, or really any other external threat. The parameters that are controlled in a greenhouse are light, ventilation, humidity, and temperature. This would allow the farmers to create the kind of optimal micro-ecosystem that would eventually lead to them growing healthier, tastier, more nutritious, and, you know, better-looking produce.
What you will find in this smart greenhouse are tomatoes, cherry tomatoes, bell pepper, and cucumbers. There are certain types of fruits and vegetables that are preferred to be used in greenhouses, for example, the ones that I just mentioned. And there are certain types of crops that are not optimal for greenhouse use, for example,
wheat and rice. So, but that's just some information about greenhouses in general. What makes this particular greenhouse unique and smart is that all of the parameters that need to be kept in check in a greenhouse are all monitored and manipulated remotely through the cloud and Internet of Things, instead of some worker or some farmers coming in and out of the greenhouse to manipulate things manually. That's the smart aspect of it in a nutshell. But to find out more information about the smartness of this greenhouse, let's hear from some of the experts here.
In this greenhouse, we measure all essential parameters for the plants, like temperature, moisture, CO2, ambient light, the water parameters, and the moisture of the roots, using the available sensors and control them with the actuators and the smart control unit. And also remotely control it via Internet of Things. With properly controlling the climate and the irrigation system, we increase the productivity up to 30% and decrease the water consumption by up to 40% comparing other hydroponic greenhouses in our country. And in the next step, we are trying to recycle the drained water of the irrigation system and pass it through some filters and put it back again into the irrigation system in order to further decrease the water consumption. And also, we are developing a robotic harvester, including a mobile-based manipulator, soft gripper, and vision system equipped with artificial intelligent algorithm in order to detect the ripe crops and pick them in the proper time.
1% of the world's water resources are fresh water, and most of it, in fact, 70% of it, is used in agriculture. What we choose to do with that tiny, finite reserve is a responsibility that we need to bear. Greenhouses can control the irrigation of plants. You may have sophisticated plumbing systems in the ground or in the cocoa peats, as you will see, to prevent overwatering, which can promote rots and fungal diseases, and reduce evaporation, saving huge amounts of water in the process. There is even the option to recycle the runoff water and put it back into the system to further save up on water. The great thing about this particular smart greenhouse is that you don't need to be born into a farmer family that has thousands of acres of land to make this a viable option to you. You can own land as small as 100 square meters and it would still be a financially viable option for you. Especially since after the initial installation phase and the setup process, you won't be needing much manpower to control the environment.
Interest has been shown in this smart greenhouse by certain countries, especially in Africa, such as Kenya, Niger, and Ethiopia. The idea, and of course the working proof of the idea, really has the potential to shake up the industry. And if it catches on, it can only mean good things for the farmers and the food sector in general. Thank you for staying tuned to another episode of Bazaar.
Many thanks for that wonderful report. Now for our final portion of the programme, let's check out some news and trends in the food and agriculture industries and some of its related trades. The agriculture sector is shifting towards technology to realise a new generation of agriculture in the country. Iranian knowledge-based companies have developed dozens of technological products in this field.
The Vice Presidential Office for Science and Technology says some 120 technologies have already been produced by 30 knowledge-based companies. These items are now being integrated into the industry. The products cover everything from cultivation to harvest and sales of crops and play an essential role in the productivity and sustainability of crops.
Agriculture is one of the fields in which nanotechnology has been able to develop. Over 50 widely used nano products have been launched in this sector this year alone.
The potential of nanotechnology in agriculture is high. Over 7,000 knowledge-based companies in the country are actively manufacturing a wide range of domestically needed products. Roughly 260 companies of this total are active in agriculture, biotechnology, and the food industry.
Well, that brings us to the end of our show today. I've been Samson Sees. Sees you in the next bazaar.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The United Nations has said the United Kingdom's controversial bill aimed at stopping thousands of migrants and refugees from arriving is at odds with the country's obligations under international law. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to WION, the United Nations has slammed the British illegal migration bill just when it got parliamentary assent on July 18th. In a sharp reaction, the UN has said that the bill, which awaits formality of the royal assent to become a law, is against London's obligations under international law. In a joint statement, the UN refugee and human rights chiefs said that the bill is at variance with the country's obligations under international human rights and refugee law and will have profound consequences for people in need of international protection. The controversial bill seeks to stop thousands of migrants arriving on British shores in small boats. The bill has cleared its last parliamentary hurdle. The members of the House of Lords, the unelected upper house, defeated a string of challenges to the government's illegal migration bill. The bill is central to UK Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's pledge to stop the boats. UN Refugees head Filippo Grandi said, "This new legislation significantly erodes the legal framework that has protected so many, exposing refugees to grave risks in breach of international law." He said, "I urge the UK government to renew this commitment to human rights by reversing this law and ensuring that the rights of all migrants, refugees and asylum seekers are respected, protected and fulfilled without discrimination." The bill, when it becomes a law, will mean that anyone arriving by boat will be denied the right to apply for asylum in the UK. As the Parliament has passed the bill, it will now await the formality of the royal assent from King Charles. The legislation provides for measures which are seen as a deterrent to migrants. The bill says that all irregular arrivals may be transferred to safe third countries such as Rwanda. This means that a migrant who may not be from Rwanda can potentially be transferred there. In 2022, more than 45,000 migrants arrived on the shores of Southeast England in small boats. This was a 60% annual increase in the influx of migrants. The sea route is perilous and has been used by more people since 2018. Recently, three Court of Appeal judges in the UK ruled that Rwanda cannot be considered a safe third country. The UK government said last month that it would appeal the judgment. Prime Minister Sunak has said he respects the court but fundamentally disagrees with the conclusions drawn by the judges. Till now, no deportation flights to Rwanda have taken place. Rights groups accuse Rwanda ruled with an iron fist by President Paul Kagame since the end of 1994 genocide that killed around 800,000 people of cracking down on free speech and opposition. According to France 24, Britain's controversial plan to deter migrants without papers from landing on British shores was poised to become law, prompting criticism from the United Nations. The legislation would outlaw asylum claims by all arrivals via the Channel and other illegal routes and transfer them to third countries such as Rwanda. It was proposed in response to years of growing numbers of dangerous cross-channel journeys from northern France in small boats. Opposition to the bill was finally crushed at late night, sitting just hours before a barge that will be used to house migrants arrived at a port on England's south coast. The BB Stockholm barge moored in Dorset's Portland port is expected to house 500 asylum seekers from later this month. The UN Refugee Agency condemned the passage of the government's illegal migration bill as a breach of international law and warned it would expose refugees to grave risks. UN High Commissioner for Refugees Filippo Grandi said this new legislation significantly erodes the legal framework that has protected so many.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Nearly 1 month into a military coup in Niger, the situation remains tense there as the country grapples with political uncertainty. As part of efforts to reverse last month's coup, a delegation from West Africa's main regional bloc, ECOWAS, has met with junta leader General Abdourahamane Tiani in the capital, Niamey. The delegation led by Nigeria's former military leader, Abdulsalami Abubakar, and accompanied by ECOWAS Commission President Omar Touray, has also met with Nigeria's ousted President Mohamed Bazoum. Although there has been no detail on the outcome of the talks, General Tiani said in a televised address that neither coup leaders nor the Nigerian people want war and remain open to dialogue.
In short, neither the military junta nor the people of Niger want war and remain open to dialogue. But let us be clear, if an aggression is launched against us, it will not be the easy ride that some people think it is. They will be up against 26 million Nigerians.
Tiani said the junta was pursuing its own agenda and would launch a national dialogue to consult on a transition back to democracy, which should last no longer than 3 years.
I am calling on all the living forces to engage in an inclusive national dialogue. The aim of the body dedicated to this dialogue is to consult all the components of the people of Niger and the best ways to lay the foundations of a new constitutional life on pillars deeply rooted in our traditional and republican values.
Tiani's comments and meeting of ECOWAS representatives with coup leaders and former President Bazoum come as the bloc on Friday doubled down its threat to use force as a last resort to restore democracy in Niger. It said an undisclosed D-Day had been agreed for possible military intervention there. This was enough reason for thousands of Nigerians to hit the streets of Niamey to throw their backing behind coup leaders. The developments in Niger come as coups are normally rejected by nature, no matter the time and place they take place. But the public support for the military junta does indeed convey a message. The disillusionment and dissatisfaction with the previous regime can be named as such. A desire for change and a belief that the military might bring stability or address grievances that have not been adequately addressed by the previous government is among reasons behind the public support for Niger junta leaders. But in the case of the West's stance toward Niger developments, what comes to the spotlight is Western countries' push for a military intervention in Niger to reverse the coup. Are they really seeking for the establishment of a civilian rule, or are there real concerns that the persistence of a military rule would not meet the demands of people across the West African nation? Western countries claim that they are involved in a fight against terrorists linked to Al-Qaeda and Daesh. But taking a glimpse at West's interests in Niger proves that seeking a civilian rule in Niger for the sake of its people would be so naive. In the case of France, Paris is seeking to maintain its grip on valuable uranium reserves in Niger. After all, the French government is entirely dependent on Niger, as some 25% of Niger's uranium production goes to France. Using that uranium to produce electricity, Paris has become a large exporter of power that goes to Germany and other European countries. This makes France huge profits, which make it hard for Paris to admit new political changes in Niger. In the case of the United States, Washington is seeing a growing tendency toward Russia among people in West African nations, including Niger, Burkina Faso, and Mali. Maybe that's why, seeing its political interests in tatters, Washington is pushing for a military intervention in Niger to reinstate the pro-Western president. All what it is, the fact that Niger belongs to Nigerians and they're the ones who should decide their own fate is of very high significance. Given all the anti-West hatred among the people of Niger and other nations across the Sahel region, it seems that it is for the West to stop meddling in the affairs of those countries and let the people decide their own political future. The situation remains volatile around Taiwan as Chinese military has carried out joint exercises there. In a statement, the Chinese Defense Ministry said it carried out joint naval and air combat readiness patrols around the island. It said it was holding the exercises and training of naval and air forces, focusing on ship aircraft coordination and seizing control to test the forces' actual combat capabilities. The Chinese military said the equipment deployed included destroyers, frigates and missile boats, as well as fighters, early warning and jamming aircraft that assembled in a predetermined area. Taiwan's defense ministry said it detected 42 Chinese aircraft and 8 ships involved in the drills around the island as of Saturday morning, and it had deployed ships and aircraft in response. The Chinese military said the maneuvers were a serious warning against Taiwan independent separatist forces colluding with external forces to provoke. Taiwan's government strongly condemned the drills. The Taiwanese Defense Ministry said it had the ability, determination, and confidence to ensure national security of Taiwan. The government's Mainland Affairs Council, which makes Taiwan's China policy, urged Beijing to stop what it called the intimidation and start talks, saying Taiwan's people were determined to defend themselves and would never succumb to threats of force. The council added Taiwan is a sovereign country and has a legitimate and legal right to conduct normal diplomatic interactions with friendly countries. The drill comes against the backdrop of a visit by Taiwan's Vice President William Lai to the United States. Lai, who was a frontrunner to become Taiwan's president in elections in January, made a number of stopovers and gave speeches while on the visit. This stopover of Taiwan's vice president to the U.S. comes as previous instances of such diplomatic visits have been the source of tensions between Beijing and Taipei, and subsequently China and the United States. That includes a visit by former Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi. Beijing launched joint military exercises around the island and suspended or canceled 8 official military dialogues and cooperation channels with the United States. In April this year, Taiwan's President Tsai Ing-wen met House Speaker Kevin McCarthy on a stopover in California. Beijing authorities blasted off some angry statements, imposed sanctions against a handful of individuals or entities involved in Tsai's trip, and sent warships and planes past Taiwan. Not to mention that several U.S. delegations, comprising of American lawmakers, have traveled to the self-ruled island and met with Taiwanese officials, drawing angry reactions from Beijing. China argues that any official exchanges with Taiwan will boost calls for independence in the self-ruled island. But apart from those diplomatic exchanges, tensions over Taiwan have been escalating ever since the United States enhanced its military buildup in the South China Sea in an effort to contain Beijing. After all, China has territorial claims over the self-ruled island and has warned against any move that jeopardizes its sovereignty and territorial integrity. But regardless of those warnings, Washington has continued with its collision course with Beijing over the issue of Taiwan. The sailing of U.S. vessels through the Taiwan Strait is just to name one. That raises the question that how would the United States react if Chinese destroyers sail through areas close to U.S. borders in the North Atlantic or the North Pacific Oceans, or anywhere near the Gulf of Mexico for that matter. Given all the tensions between Washington and Beijing, what seems to be further complicating the situation is numerous provocations on the part of the United States against China. From those diplomatic visits to sailing of warships to areas close to Taiwan, all seems to be preparing the ground for full-scale confrontation between the two countries.
The United Nations has warned that millions of people across Sudan are running out of food and are on the brink of famine as the situation in the war-torn northeast African country is spiraling out of control. The international body has said the ongoing armed conflict has impeded agricultural activities, causing millions of people to face acute food insecurity. Many people are also dying due to lack of healthcare. Time is running out for farmers to plant the crops that will feed them and their neighbors. The situation is spiraling out of control.
It's looting humanitarian supplies, targeting aid workers and hospitals, or blocking aid. Things we have seen throughout those 4 months may amount to war crimes and crimes against humanity.
According to the UN, the war has caused over 1 million people to cross from Sudan into neighboring countries. many already struggling with the impact of conflicts or economic crises. Those displaced within Sudan are estimated to number over 3.4 million people. Furthermore, more than 6 million people in Sudan are one step away from famine. More than 14 million children need humanitarian aid. The statement comes as 4 months of a power struggle between Sudan's army and the paramilitary rapid support forces has killed nearly 4,000 people. The conflict erupted on April 15th over tensions linked to a planned transition to civilian rule, plunging the country into violence. UN officials also say reports of sexual assaults have increased in the country.
Just to give you an idea, we've seen an increase of more than 900% in the conflict areas of gender-based violence. 900%. Those women are incredibly at risk, and we really do need the funding and the access to those areas to be able to provide services for them.
Reports from our protection and field teams in neighboring Chad, Central African Republic, Egypt, and South Sudan have also described the horrific ordeals faced by women and girls in Sudan. Shocking incidents of sexual violence, including rape, sexual assault, sexual exploitation, and physical violence, have been reported by women and girls who have fled the conflict.
Fighting in Sudan broke out back in April over a power struggle between two rival generals, Army Chief Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and former deputy Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo.
Once we put on these khakis, we have no other path. We do not get startled or afraid. And even if every one of us is dead, we will not be frightened or back away.
The clashes initially broke out in Khartoum and later spread to Darfur. The roots of the crisis dates to several years ago. In 2019, a coup d'etat ousted the country's longtime ruler, Omar al-Bashir, in the context of massive civil disobedience. An interim joint civilian military unity government headed by Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok was established. However, in October 2021, the military seized power in a coup which was led by the Sudanese Armed Forces leader Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and Rapid Support Forces led by Hamdan Dagalo. Rapid Support Forces evolved from so-called Janjaweed militias which fought in a conflict in the 2000s in the Darfur region. Over time, the militia grew. It was made into the RSF in 2013 and its forces were used as border guards in particular. In 2017, a law legitimizing the RSF as an independent security force was passed. There are also indications that Bashir-era loyalists in the army feared that a new political agreement would significantly harm their economic and political power. Many of these loyalists blame RSF leader Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo for turning on al-Bashir in 2019. Despite peace efforts, fighting continued unabated in the African country, with the army and the RSF trading blame over truce violations. In May, the two warring sides agreed to send negotiating teams to Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, to start talks brokered by Riyadh and Washington. At least 16 ceasefire agreements followed, with each of them collapsing.
The U.S. military has decided to send F-16 fighter planes to Ukraine from Denmark and the Netherlands as soon as the training of Ukrainian pilots is completed. A U.S. official said on Thursday Washington has assured both countries that it will expedite approval of transfer requests for F-16s to go to Ukraine when their pilots are trained. The U.S. must approve the transfer of F-16s from its allies to Ukraine. A coalition of 11 countries was due to start training Ukrainian pilots to fly fighter jets this month in Denmark.
As you know, Denmark and the Netherlands are taking the lead on training. We have, and the president has given the green light to allow and support the training to move forward, but I just don't have any further updates at this time when it comes to specific pilots being trained.
The thing is that it is a very strong weapon system. It's a very strong capability, but it's not going to be available anytime soon. And President Zelensky, of course, knows that.
U.S. officials have privately said that F-16 fighter jets would be no game changer when they arrive, given Russia's air defense systems and its air superiority, that the request would be approved. The U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken sent letters to his Danish and Dutch counterparts, assuring them that the request would be approved. He said the approval of the request would allow Ukraine to take full advantage of its new capabilities as soon as the first set of pilots complete their training.
Officials in Kiev have repeatedly requested the F-16s. Some NATO states have agreed to instruct Ukrainian pilots, but it remains unclear when the first transfer could occur. U.S. President Joe Biden endorsing training programs for Ukrainian pilots on F-16s in May, but no timing for the supply of the warplanes has been declared yet. According to a recent report in the Washington Post, the initial batch of Ukrainian pilots trained on F-16 will not be ready until after the summer of 2024, with only six airmen set to complete the first round of instructions.
Flying-wise, well, technically, I mean, if you're a pilot, this is also just an airplane. But to fly a fighter jet and to transition to an F-16, which for them would mean, like, different technology, different design concepts.
Russia has repeatedly warned that the influx of Western weapons and military equipment only prolongs the conflict and increases the risk of military confrontation with NATO. Moscow has said Western powers would run, quote, colossal risks if they decided to supply the F-16. Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has said that Russia would consider the aircraft a nuclear threat due to its ability to carry atomic weapons.
Yes, look, that's right. I mean, the pro-war people keep saying, look, it's up to Ukraine to decide when to negotiate. But the reality is the U.S. is funding practically 100% of this war, and the allies are providing 100% of the munitions. So at any time they could say, look, you know, enough's enough. We're not going to do this anymore. And then, of course, Ukraine would have to negotiate.
Ukraine says its troops have recaptured a village from Russian forces in the southeastern Donetsk region. Ukraine's deputy defense minister said forces have secured their position by erecting defensive lines on the outskirts of the village. There was no immediate response to the Ukrainian claim from Moscow. Separately, Russian drones inflicted damage upon grain facilities at Danube Port in the southern region of Odessa. Ukraine has also launched a number of cross-border drone attacks inside of Russia. Meanwhile, NATO member Poland has held its biggest military parade since the Cold War in an event that marked victory over Soviet forces in 1920. Warsaw showcased the country's state-of-the-art weaponry as the war was raging in neighboring Ukraine. Poland's army has more than 175,000 troops, an increase from approximately 100,000 8 years ago.
There are existing risks associated with the militarization of Poland, which has become the main instrument of the United States' anti-Russian policy. Warsaw announced the intention to build, according to the polls, the most powerful army on the continent.
Poland has also expressed concern about the movement of Wagner forces in Belarus towards the Polish border. The Polish Prime Minister has said, "We have information that more than 100 Wagner mercenaries have advanced towards the Suwalki Gap, not far from Grodno in Belarus. Grodno is located in the west of Belarus, about 15 kilometers from its border with NATO members Poland and Lithuania. The Suwalki Gap is a narrow strategic land corridor on their territory between Belarus and Russia's Baltic exclave of Kaliningrad. Poland is worried about its security with Russian ally Belarus and Ukraine on its eastern border.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. In the United States, FEMA Administrator Deanne Criswell says the Federal Emergency Management Agency's disaster fund may be depleted by mid-September, in a matter of weeks. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. National broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. The Federal Emergency Management Agency FEMA's disaster fund could dry up within weeks and delay the federal response to natural disasters, the agency's administrator warned on Sunday, 20th of August. FEMA Administrator Deanne Criswell told CBS's Face the Nation program that the agency is watching its disaster relief fund very closely ahead of hurricane season and that some recovery projects that are not life-saving measures could be delayed into the next fiscal year if funding falls short. Our estimates do still say that we may have a depletion of our fund. Now it's pushed into the middle of September, Deanne Criswell said. And as we get closer to that, this is a day-to-day monitoring of the situation. According to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, there were 15 weather or climate disaster events this year before 8th of August, with each causing more than $1 billion worth of damage. The tally does not include the recent wildfires on Maui, Hawaii, which decimated Lahaina, causing an estimated $6 billion in damage to the coastal city. The peak of hurricane season is not until 11th of September. President Joe Biden asked Congress earlier this month for $12 billion to replenish the disaster fund to address the response to the wildfires and other natural disasters. Congress is on recess until after Labor Day. Deanne Criswell says the amount may not be enough. The $12 billion was going to be able to cover some of the immediate needs that we were going to need to get through this fiscal year, she said, as we are continuing to see the increasingly severe weather events that dollar amount may need to go up as we go into the next fiscal year. Criswell is traveling with President Joe Biden to Maui, Hawaii, on Monday to view the devastation and meet the survivors. The biggest thing that the president needs to see is just the actual impact, Criswell says, of the importance of the visit to Hawaii. It really feels different when you're on the ground and can see the total devastation of Lahaina. He'll talk to some of the families that have been impacted by this disaster and hear their stories. He's really going to be able to, one, bring hope to the community, but also reassure them that the federal government is there. He has directed them to bring the resources they need to help them as they begin to start their recovery and their rebuilding process. The Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, responds to wildfires. It is also preparing for the really significant impact of Tropical Storm Hilary on Southern California. FEMA Administrator Deanne Criswell says, "We had a lot of staff already on the ground in California. We're moving in some additional resources to make sure that we can support anything that California might need. But they're a very capable state as well, and they have a lot of resources. So if it does exceed what their capability is, we're going to have additional search and rescue teams, commodities on hand to be able to go in and support anything that they might ask for." United Press International, UPI, has also covered the same story and tells us more. Compounding natural disasters spurred on by extreme weather may lead to the Federal Emergency Management Agency's disaster fund becoming completely depleted within weeks, FEMA Administrator Deanne Criswell has said. Appearing on CNN's Face the Nation program, Deanne Criswell on Sunday, 20th of August, said, "The disaster fund is projected to run dry by mid-September, but the situation is day-to-day. And as we get closer to that, this is a day-to-day monitoring of the situation. We will start to move some of our recovery projects and delay them until the next fiscal year." When asked by CNN's Casey Hunt what the Federal Emergency Management Agency would do in the event of a government shutdown, Deanne Criswell said FEMA will continue to push projects into the next fiscal year so it can continue to respond to disasters immediately. We will take measures to ensure that there is always going to be enough funding to continue to support immediate responses to these types of severe weather events, she said. The projections come as Tropical Storm Hilary reached Mexico's Baja California Peninsula and heads towards Southern California, where it may drop up to 4 inches of rain per hour, causing flash floods. There have been 15 weather-related or climate disaster events that caused more than $1 billion worth of damage this year prior to 8th of August, according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the NOAA. The combined disaster cost is currently more than $39 billion. Last week, the Biden administration requested $12 billion to fund the Federal Emergency Management Agency as it undertakes recovery efforts related to multiple natural disasters. Deanne Criswell, FEMA's administrator, says the agency's response to crises will not be impacted, despite the House and Senate being in recess until after Labor Day. CNN, the cable broadcaster Cable News Network, has also covered the same story. The Federal Emergency Management Agency's disaster fund is already running out of money in a year that's setting records for billion-dollar weather disasters, all before the peak of Atlantic hurricane season has even arrived. The relief fund is expected to be depleted by the middle or end of August, according to FEMA's administrator Deanne Criswell. And now there's growing concern inside the agency the funding could lapse if Congress doesn't pass a spending bill, a FEMA official confirmed to CNN. It's been a record-breaking year for expensive disasters, including flooding, atmospheric rivers in California, and deadly tornado outbreaks. The federal government has tallied 15 weather-related disasters that have each exceeded $1 billion worth of damage, a new record for the first 7 months of the year, according to data from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the NOAA. The list doesn't yet include two of this summer's deadliest tragedies, catastrophic flooding in New England in July and the historic Maui wildfires in Hawaii. The latter disaster could cost as much as $6 billion alone, according to Hawaii Governor Josh Green. On Wednesday, Deanne Criswell told White House reporters that FEMA has enough money for its initial response to the Maui wildfires, but if Congress does not pass a $12 billion supplemental funding bill for natural disasters, it could delay recovery into next year, she said. Deanne Criswell added that FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, may potentially need more than $12 billion and is assessing that now. One thing is clear, increasingly year-round disasters fueled by the climate crisis are straining the agency's resources. FEMA is losing money, according to Steven Strader, a Villanova University professor who studies climate and natural disasters. Professor Steven Strader says we're not even in peak hurricane season yet and they're projected to be in a deficit. That signals to me everything is out of whack.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, on August 6, 2023, with a meeting with the commander's crew and families of the 86th flotilla of the Islamic Republic of Iran's Navy. The 86th flotilla's great accomplishment is an honor that has been carried out for the first time in the maritime history. If we put aside the humiliating years of the Pahlavi and Qajar rule, we did have seafaring before and it wasn't bad. But what we had before was far less than what you have accomplished today. Your flotilla brought about this great honor. A group of 350 people with an experienced, skillful commander was able to travel 65,000 kilometers circumnavigating the globe. You were at sea for almost 8 months, 232 days to be exact. These are great achievements. In the world's most renowned naval forces, there are few people who have accomplished this and are able to accomplish this. But you accomplished this. You sailed across three oceans and returned proudly to your homeland. What you accomplished is very meaningful. It cannot be viewed as being merely a naval or military event. What you did has depth.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today. And that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
I would like to mention a few things about this. First of all, this great movement shows that there is great determination, willpower, and self-confidence in our military forces. These are very important matters. Three important factors: being determined, making an effort by having willpower, and having self-confidence. In other words, having a we can mindset. That's one side of the story. There is also the matter of military knowledge and the ability to design. An important component of these operations is their design. It is very important that an organization is able to design something like this, which is the military knowledge. And yet, another dimension includes courage, perseverance, and the ability to endure hardships. We speak easily about spending 8 months at sea. However, those who have spent just 2 or 3 days at sea understand what 8 months on the water means. Enduring these hardships is very important. You see, your work tells of these truths. Each of these truths deserves attention. That is, one very important thing is that, for example, a military group was able to acquire the capability to design an operation of this kind.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.